So I see that we have a full house. We should get started. Other people will sort of walk in slowly, but we should get started. Welcome to the political theory series entitled American Political Thought, Institutions and Values. This event is co-sponsored with the by the political theory section of the Politics Department and the Miller Center. My name is Melvin Rogers. I'm assistant professor of politics at the university here. Let me say a few words about this series, and then introduce Jason. When a colleague of mine, Lori Balfour, and I proposed this series to the Miller Center, Sid, and others, we did so with two goals in mind. The first was to introduce the political theory and American politics community of faculty and graduate students to cutting-edge research in American political thought. And the second reason was to, or goal was to introduce the wider intellectual community and public to ways of thinking critically and philosophically about the tradition of American political thought. As many of you may know, the tradition of American political thought, its story, is a complicated one. And in recent years, a number of theorists have emerged with specific goals in mind, goals of examining the political philosophy upon which America is founded, of tracking the internal tensions and contradictions of the revolutionary era and beyond, and of exploring the untapped resources of the tradition, which, if explored, sort of might expand our democratic imagination. And so what better way to begin the series than with Walt Whitman, who has been dubbed by American philosopher John Dewey as the seer of American democracy, right? And although it may seem a little odd that we would begin in the Miller Center with Walt Whitman, it is not so odd. If you understand democracy is more than institutions and public policy, but also including sensibilities, habits, and ways of being upon which those institutions and those values are based. And what better scholar to help decipher the message of this seer than Jason Frank. Jason is the Gary S. Davis Assistant Professor in History of Political Thought at Cornell University. He received his MA and PhD in Political Science from the Johns Hopkins University. He is the author of the forthcoming book from Duke University Press, Constituent Moments, Enacting the People in Post-Revolutionary America, and the forthcoming book from Roman and Littlefield entitled Publius and Political Imagination. He has published widely in scholarly journals, and most recently is the co-editor of a special double issue of the Journal of Diacritics entitled Take an Exception to the Exception. Jason works on historically situated approaches to democratic theory with an emphasis on American political thought and culture. His research explores the legal and political dilemmas engendered by the American Revolution's establishment of the people as the legitimate ground of political authority. He is interested in the forms of political contestation that emerge around competing claims of those who claim to speak on behalf of the people. But his research, what is presented here today, is also concerned with the aesthetics of democratic citizenship, that elusive and yet crucial aspect that tries to capture the ways in which we are tied together, not exclusively or even principally, by principles or narrow economic interests, but tied together by feeling, affect. The title of Jason's paper today is Promiscuous Citizenship. And as is standard for our colloquium, we always have a discussant, Will Humphreys, who is a graduate student in the Department of Politics. But we will first begin with some comments from Jason, after which we will hear from Will, and then we will open it up for questions. All right, Jason?
Great. Thank you for that kind introduction, Melvin. Well, I'd like to thank the Political Theory Colloquium and the Miller Center for inviting me to the University of Virginia this afternoon. It is an honor to be presenting what is really some very recent work and work in progress in this ongoing series on American political thought. And I do want to thank in particular Melvin for inviting me to come here, and also Laura Phillips and Sarah Graham for arranging my visit. I'd like to thank Will in advance of the discussion we're going to get, although I should probably wait to see what you have. The paper that I've circulated for discussion, which is titled Promiscuous Citizenship, is a draft of an essay that is going to eventually appear in a collection on Walt Whitman and political theory. There's still plenty of time to revise this essay, so I'm looking forward to your comments and your suggestions this afternoon. As Melvin's already suggested, most of my research has primarily been focused on the political thought of the post-revolutionary and the founding period, but I've taken a few forays into 19th century American political thought with essays on Frederick Douglass and Walt Whitman and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Whitman has been a particularly provocative thinker for me, as his work weaves together three interests that have guided much of my research, including the research on the founding period. That is...
Sorry.
What it weaves together is a kind of an interest in democratic theory, contemporary democratic theory, American political thought, and an interest in the aesthetic dimensions of political life, or the relationship between aesthetics and politics. I wrestled first with Whitman, his approach to these issues in an essay that I wrote a few years ago called Aesthetic Democracy, and I returned to them with this new essay that's focused on Whitman's city writings and what I call his aesthetics of urban encounter. I take Whitman's aesthetic translation of everyday urban experience, in particular his phenomenology of contact between strangers on city streets, as the basis for reimagining citizenship in America at a time of acute political crisis, that is, the looming crisis of union in the 1850s. For Whitman, as I argue at some length in the paper, citizenship is not best understood as a formal or juridical category. It is not principally a question of legal recognition or the formal granting of rights, for example, although this is not to exclude this dimension. But he thinks of citizenship as a way of relating to others publicly, a way of relating that is charged with affectivity and promiscuous attraction. Whitman understood the growing crisis of the 1850s, a crisis that is marked by such events as the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Dred Scott decision, and John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, as a crisis in citizenship very broadly understood. That is, a crisis of lived citizenship, of perception, and of the felt experience of relation and attachment on which more formal political relationships are based. So Leaves of Grass, and I think this is maybe a bit too simply put, but I'll put it this way anyway, can be productively read as an aesthetic response to this crisis. Now, one of the points that I make in the paper and that others have made before me is that the general thematic of public love, kind of love between citizens in public. Whitman has a variety of terms for describing this love, adhesiveness, camaraderie. This general thematic is, and the emphasis on public love he distinguishes from intimate love, from the kind of love that works in the private sphere or in domestic settings. This emphasis on public love is present in the first edition of Leaves of Grass, written in 1855, but it becomes more pronounced in the subsequent editions as the crisis of union deepens, and it is most pronounced in the 1860 third edition of Leaves of Grass, which includes the remarkable Calamus cluster of poems, which I engage at some length in the paper. That which really balances and conserves the social and the political world, Whitman writes, is not so much legislation, police, treaties, or the dread of punishment. But it is the latent, eternal, intuitional sense in humanity of fairness, manliness, decorum, etc., he says. This is a charged etc. Like what else, right? This, what he calls a perennial self-regulation, is the sine qua non of democracy. And he believes, and I'm quoting here him directly, that the widest aim of a democratic literature may be to bring forth, cultivate, and strengthen this sense in individuals and society. End of quote. Now, in responding to what Whitman alternately characterized as a crisis of political detachment, solipsistic individualism, skepticism, and sectional discord, Leaves of Grass worked to transfigure the quality of public attachments and to poetically reshape the way citizens imagined and felt their way into a common democratic people. Leaves of Grass aimed to poetically reshape not only the evaluations and the judgments of its audience, but their very modes of perception, how they perceive others. Throughout the first part of the paper, I therefore focus on on the visceral dimensions of Whitman's poetry. For Whitman, it was not enough that citizens uphold common principles, say the principles of the Declaration and the Constitution, that all men are created equal. But these principles must be absorbed into the body. They must become a part of our flesh, our way of physically relating to one another. They should be manifest in comportment and gesture among others. So the contemporary political theorist William Connolly has a nice way of putting this kind of register of politics. He calls it the visceral register of our political life, our kind of gut reactions in politics, and the importance and malleability of this dimension of our political experience. Now, particular interest to Whitman were visceral forms of democratic attachment. Whitman's poetry reiterates time and again, on different registers and with different inflections, the question, what is there between us? For him, this question was particularly pressing in the United States, because here, according to Whitman, the usual means of political attachment were of no avail. That is, political attachment could not be grounded in a romantic and nostalgic appeal to a single common tradition, to a common language, ethnicity, or race. However, he also believed that modern substitutes for traditional attachments were insufficient for the robust and transformative understanding of democratic life that he affirmed. So, for example, for Whitman, reasoned allegiance to common principles and formal procedures, what some contemporary democratic theorists characterize as a constitutional patriotism, were too thinly cognitive to achieve the kind of binding effects that he looked for. Forms of political obligation based on economic interest, an economic theory of political attachment, was too narrowly calculating to engender the sense of democratic capacity and collective efficacy that he thought necessary for a democratic politics. Insofar as Whitman can be said to have a democratic theory, and part of what I'm doing in both this paper and in the earlier paper is to suggest that he does have something like a democratic theory. You can tease a democratic theory out of Whitman's work. Insofar as he has a democratic theory, it falls outside of current debates in democratic theory between proponents of democratic deliberation, deliberative Democrats on the one hand, and aggregative Democrats on the other, those who see democracy as the kind of aggregation of interests. Both of them neglect the prior importance of or the importance of a prior investment of the public imagination in belonging to a common people. I'm going to return to this question at the very end of what will be a very short presentation. Democratic attachment for Whitman required an aesthetic component, but one that was itself democratic, right? So to In the paper, I quote Burke on this: "To love one's country, one must make one's country lovely, or one's country must be lovely." Right? There's so this important aesthetic component for Whitman, but not an aesthetic component that was itself invested in aristocratic hierarchies of talents and virtues, or one that actively, and he outlined a kind of a democratic aesthetics that actively resisted the equally aesthetic lures of demonization. Right? So I'm going to quote Whitman here. "Of all of the dangers to the nation, there can be none greater than having certain portions of the people set off from the rest by a line drawn, they not privileged as others, but degraded, humiliated, made of no account." End of quote. Whitman is calling for, or better, attempting to poetically elicit an attachment to a common and public world comprised of vital differences in Leaves of Grass. I argue in the paper that he does this importantly through the image of promiscuous citizenship that is derived from his writings on the city. Now let me emphasize that there are multiple images of citizenship in Whitman's work. There is a kind of universalizing, transcendental citizenship that can be found in, for example, the Song of Adam series in Leaves of Grass. There is also a more aggressive, imperial citizenship in some of Whitman's late writings on the Spanish-American War. I'm not making any claim that this is the only image of citizenship, but I do want to make the claim that it is the most insightful and provocative image of citizenship that you get in Whitman's work, and one that is potentially productive for debates in contemporary democratic theory. In sharp contrast to prevailing traditions of democratic anti-urbanism in America, whether the agrarian pastoral Jeffersonian democracy or transcendentalists embracing nature and the wild, for Whitman, the modes of experience and subjectivity that were kind of elicited by living in a city were not necessarily corrupting or alienating of the character required for democratic citizenship, but actively productive of it. The city offered what Whitman characterized as an endless and unspoken lesson in democratic citizenship. Now, in the paper, I want to argue that for Whitman, it is the erotic energies among and between non-intimates promiscuously mixing in the city streets that served as a vital source of a democratic spirit. In everyday urban encounters, Whitman discerned what the critic William Pannepacker has called the promiscuous attractions of all people towards each other. Now, this is a claim that can really only be substantiated by turning to the poetry itself, and I'm not going to completely reiterate what I've done in the paper. But let me do say that Whitman offers, the argument is that he offers a poetic translation of urban experience that is at once unsettling of any given perspective or experience, right? We're kind of unsettled by these continual confrontations with other people in these crowded urban streets that Whitman often positions his poetry within. So it unsettles, and it is the basis for an effective attachment or commitment to a shared public world. Both of these dimensions are crucial to what I call the aesthetics of urban encounter in Whitman's poetry. Now, the first dimension is closely associated with the poetry of the urban sublime. Right? For Whitman, urban experience has a kind of sublimity to it. Whitman took the experience of the sublime out of the romantic solitude of nature and associated it with the surging crowds of Manhattan. Quoting Whitman, "People, endless, streaming, electric with strong voices, passions, and pageants." Whitman felt the human crowd, William James insightfully wrote, as rapturously as Wordsworth felt the mountains. Whitman's invocation of the urban sublime, what he called the arresting wonder that everyone sees and everyone else that he sees, has interesting parallels to what Thoreau characterizes as the tonic of nature in Walden, and I say a little bit about that in the paper. But alongside this urban sublime, the curious abrupt questionings of urban experience, is this attempt to make visible in everyday forms of attachment between strangers that usually go unseen, right, unremarked, certainly uncelebrated. Whitman at once makes visible and valorizes these forms of attachment between strangers that do not convert strangers into intimates, but take the fact of their separateness as a source of attachment. So Whitman's greatest poetic celebration of this dynamic, I would argue, is the great poem Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, which I talk about very briefly in the essay. And it's there that he writes, "What is more subtle than this which ties me to the man or woman that looks in my face?" And then there's a long kind of reflection about what makes up that subtle connection. Okay, I've been told that most people have read the essay, so I'm not going to go through any more summary of the argument. But let me do. I want to conclude with one broad theoretical point, I guess. It's a point that's invoked in the essay, but it's not really developed. And so I want to kind of state it here at the outset and in conclusion. The point concerns what I characterize, following a contemporary a theorist, Clarissa Hayward, as the binding and bounding problem in contemporary democratic theory. What does that mean? Whitman's image of promiscuous citizenship, I want to suggest, was his way of responding to a very familiar dilemma in contemporary democratic theory. How to affectively bind citizens together so that they can act collectively as citizens while mitigating the violence done to the plural constituencies that make up a democratic people. While the discussion of promiscuous citizenship that I offer in the paper is obviously anchored in Whitman's account, I wrote this paper for a collection on Walt Whitman and political theory, I am interested in developing this idea a bit further and free of Whitman's work. I become very interested more broadly, but especially in relationship to a book that Melvin mentioned that I'm writing right now on Publius and the Federalist Papers, in how imagination is enlisted to resolve dilemmas in democratic theory around who gets included within a democratic people. So I'm going to state the problem as a kind of formal or almost logical problem. This is a familiar problem for democratic theorists. Who makes up the people is not a question that can be democratically resolved or decided, because the very question undermines the premises of its resolution. That is, who would deliberate on the question? That's precisely what is to be decided upon. This has sometimes been characterized as the boundary problem in democratic theory. Others have engaged it in terms of the paradox of founding or the paradox of politics. It might be best characterized as the paradox of the people. I'm interested in how this dilemma is resolved through imagination rather than through reason. Democratic politics cannot take shape until a people is imaginable. That's a quote from Daniel Allen. The prior investment of the imagination in defining a democratic people, an investment that precedes both aggregative and deliberative conceptions of democratic decision making for the political theorists in the audience, places aesthetic considerations, it seems to me, at the heart of democratic theory. The canonical text that wrestles with this problem most famously is Book 2, Chapter 7 of Rousseau's Social Contract, the chapter on the lawgiver. I want to suggest that Whitman also wrestles with this problem, and that political theorists might productively consider his work in that light. And with that, I'm going to turn the time over to Will.
Okay. So, well, first I just want to start by thanking Professor Frank for what's obviously a very provocative and interesting paper. There's a lot in it, and I obviously won't be able to address everything, but I do want to offer just a really, really quick recap of what I take to be central to this paper, and then offer three comments or criticisms I think that are raised. So, to begin with, Professor Frank Hruskin's promiscuous citizenship locates in Walt Whitman's poetry, particularly in Leaves of Grass, a provocative response to what he calls, and here quoting, "a familiar dilemma of democratic theory. How to effectively bind citizens together as a self-authorizing people while mitigating the violence done to the plural constituencies that make up a democratic people." This was the note he just closed on. Whitman's celebration of urban life, Frank finds a foundation for a sense of commonality without intimacy that is well suited to this task of binding together diverse people. Rather than relying on traditional notions of citizenship, they refer to fixed attributes such as common race, ethnicity, culture, tradition, or even institutional structure, Whitman is offering a more flexible, more open, more promiscuous basis for common association. Whitman himself was clearly aware of this problem, and Professor Frank points out, especially in his anonymous self-reviews of Leaves of Grass, which, I mean, I just love that you can anonymously self-review.
He was his own best reader.
Yeah, he's clearly onto something here.
We'll put you on your dissertation committee.
That's, yeah. I'll chair it.
Anonymously.
But Whitman was acutely aware of the importance of what Professor Frank calls restoring Americans' corrupted appreciation of the common. The important thing here is that instead of articulating a new common foundation of national identity, turning it back to fixed attributes, Whitman is proposing a dramatic rethinking of the meaning of citizenship. He wants to replace shared meanings, traditions, and institutions with an appreciation of this neglected commons. This means encouraging an appreciation of the attachments that bind human beings beyond their recognition and consciousness, so the connections that they're not even aware of. Rather than relying on fixed attributes, Whitman advocates cultivating this aesthetic connection. It was, he thought, the task of the poet, Whitman's task, to make the people feel these attachments. Thus, to quote the famous line, the poet is the joiner, and that he makes the people aware of the hidden and subtle connections that bind them. He is able to join them because he already sees how they join. This joining forms the basis for Professor Frank's ideal of promiscuous citizenship. Promiscuous citizenship is characterized as the undiscriminating, mixed, disorderly formation of intense but passing attachments to strangers that we encounter. The cultivation of such an experience would seem to form the basis for the kind of effective attachment that can foster allegiance to common democratic life, so responding to this dilemma of citizenship. It's helpful to understand this to look at the urban circumstances in which Whitman locates these practices of promiscuous citizenship, where Americans from Jefferson to Emerson had found the city isolating and alienating and thus anathema to the task of citizenship. Whitman found in urban life a vitalizing and unifying experience. When one is immersed in the endless crowd, one experiences an unsettling loss of self. In the crowd, we realize that we're just one of its many members. This prompts both a disorientation and, interestingly, a desire. We wonder at the variety, and we also feel passionate attachment to these strangers around us. We develop promiscuous connections with those we see. This attachment then becomes the foundation for a wider sense of commonality and belonging. It forges a new feeling of citizenship. By transferring the site of citizenship practices from the homogeneous rural communities to the city's tumultuous crowd, Whitman is able to revitalize the strained bonds of American affection. So that's what I take to be sort of the central argument here. If that account's largely correct, I think three issues come up. First, I want to ask who can engage in this kind of citizenship, how readily it might be available. Second, I want to push on how far these attachments can extend. Does promiscuous citizenship forge bonds sufficient to respond to this the dilemma of democratic citizenship? And then together, I think these point to a third, broader issue, one that focuses on the requirements of citizenship more generally. I want to show us that these are born out of a sympathy with the project, a sympathy with the desire to rethink the terms of national union or national association. What I'm trying to do is think through some of the implications of this idea of promiscuous citizenship in practice. So first, I worry about the public nature of promiscuous citizenship and the way that publicity might magnify the effects of extant status and power inequalities. Promiscuous citizenship requires that we present ourselves to others rather boldly. It's in public, on the street, that we encounter them. We enter the crowd, offering ourselves for public view. This entails certain risks. There's no guaranteeing that entering the crowd might not be the alienating experience many have found it to be. In order to navigate the crowds, to walk among them confidently, you have to be willing to lose yourself in them. You must already possess a certain status. You must be secure enough in your identity that you can afford to have it called into question. But not everyone can or should run this risk, I want to suggest. After all, to freed blacks, slaves, newly arrived immigrants, women, all of these who populated Whitman's New York, this experience of the crowd might have been very different, very unsettling, prompting uncertainty and insecurity. Risking themselves might be the last thing they'd want to do. Instead of commonality, the crowd might magnify their sense of exclusion, marginalization, or inferiority. Professor Frank describes the passing glances and longing looks that form the basis of attachment for Whitman. Leaving aside the danger that many marginalized and excluded individuals risk in expressing such naked desire, the experience of being fixed by a self-confident gaze, by being the object of desire, could serve to reinforce extant power hierarchies. For those without status, the glance is not shared, or at least it's not easily shared. In a related way, I worry that despite its professed openness, promiscuous citizenship could result in a dangerous insensitivity to the claims of others. It seems to me that Whitman's engagement with the other is ultimately one-sided. Others are seen more than they're heard. They're encountered, but they're never really engaged. Frank is clear that the attachment here is fleeting and transitory. There's no serious effort to understand the claims that others are making. Instead, there's a presumption that what one sees, the image one projects onto this stranger, is accurate. As one of the fellow grad students in the program here once pointed out to me, Whitman is not, in fact, the hounded slave, and he is not winced at the bite of dogs. He can't really take on that identity. He can't take on that self and claim to speak for it. And in trying to, he at best distorts the claims that those identities would make. At worst, you could argue that he silences them, letting his own experience stand in for theirs. So, in short, my first concern is that on the one hand, not everyone can or should hazard themselves in the crowd so that they're not the practices of promiscuous citizenship aren't available to them. And on the other, that the anonymity of the crowd leads to a one-sided encounter with others that deepens senses of exclusion and renders us deaf to the claims of others. All right, so that's the first issue I want to raise. Second, in a more conventional vein, I'm not quite convinced that the kind of generalized affective attachments that promiscuous citizenship encourages are adequate as a response to this dilemma of citizenship. Again, Whitman offers us generalized, anonymous, affective bonds. These are to replace the sense of common identity based on shared history, beliefs, etc., that have been shattered by the Civil War and by an encroaching modernity. But given just these dissociative forces, it's not clear to me that practices of promiscuous citizenship can really bind us together as a people in ways that minimize the harm we inflict on each other. To focus first on the harm, without some deeper sense of shared identity, the magnitude of our difference can turn into a disorienting encounter, can turn the disorienting encounter into a threatening encounter. As common markers disappear, it's easy to imagine the crowd triggering hostility and not affection. Indeed, the New York draft riots demonstrated how easily the anonymous and endless multitudes can turn into the mob that Jefferson and Tocqueville feared. Given their common source, this disorienting encounter of the crowd, it's difficult for me to see how the effective bonds of promiscuous citizenship could effectively check that violence. On the other hand, turning now to the sense of national commonality that it might provoke, it's difficult to see how these bonds could be extended to those whom we don't encounter regularly, who we don't see on the street, not represented in the crowd, and whose differences are more striking to us than their similarities. So, to put it in context, do the bonds of citizenship really encompass those in the southern states and the defeated Confederacy? Can they really form, then, the foundation for democratic solidarity? In our contemporary times, can they call forth the mutual sacrifice necessary to realize the efforts to achieve substantive equality or justice? Lincoln's inaugural here, I think, offers a useful contrast. Though, like Whitman, Lincoln is, of course, concerned to reforge the bonds of affection between Americans, he does so through appeals to shared religion, shared suffering, shared guilt, shared hope, and shared ideals. Such deep and specific ties are necessary, he thinks, to inspire Americans to set aside the rancor and bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, for his widow, and for his orphan. These are the tasks of citizenship, and they seem to call for a foundation that calls forth mutual sacrifice even where affection is lost. All of which is again to say that it's not clear to me how the practices of promiscuous citizenship might completely respond to either aspect of the dilemma of democratic citizenship. Which leads, I think, to maybe my final point, and it's a general one, and I'll be brief. I just want to suggest that maybe part of the difficulty here comes from an ambiguity about what really would be necessary to respond to this dilemma of democratic citizenship. What must a theory of citizenship offer? And I think thinking about that would require spelling out more clearly what democratic citizenship itself is and what it requires. Is it primarily this sense of commonality or solidarity? Or does it have to go deeper to provide a basis for common and mutual obligations? Similarly, how strongly are these attachments held? How do they have to interact with other commitments? I think focusing on these questions might enable us to answer some of these the issues I raised before. So with that, I want to turn it back over to Professor Franklin.
Thanks, Will. Thank you.
So let's open it to questions. So we have Chris and then Stephen.
Hi, Professor Frank, thanks for the paper. I really did enjoy it, and I think that you've done a tough thing in somewhat systematizing a person who's not a natural dialogue with political theory and trying to get political theorists to think about a person in a pretty systematic way, and I think you've done a good job here. I think some of the concerns that Will is raising is really basic. One, why ought we do this, and how ought we do this? And one of the things that Will has raised is that, well, Lincoln has given us some things to be concerned about, shared suffering, shared religiosity. And I actually think that there's opportunity in your paper to say two things. One, Whitman is actually addressing something that comes prior to being able to share suffering and religiosity. That's a kind of openness and willingness to accept other people. And I think there's something in the paper that's underdeveloped that can actually be a very powerful tool in this regard. The last third of the paper, you have this very fascinating discussion of Whitman replacing his name with his image in the leaves of grass. And what this is a political act, right? This is him willing to be anonymous by name, but public by image instead,
right.
An act. And I think there's something here that says if everyone was willing to kind of engage in this kind of, I mean, look at the picture, right? Your interpretation, it's kind of openness. The shirt's open, the sensuous lips, there's no name. He's dressed in a very kind of...
sensuous lips was somebody else described. I was approvingly quoting it, it's true.
So he's dressed in a certain kind of way that's meant to kind of bring down the pretentiousness of a poet.
Yeah.
And I think this is a certain kind of powerful way you could be positioning Whitman by developing this discussion towards the end. I think that preempts some of the kind of obvious criticisms you're going to get from it along the line that Will has presented, because these are legitimate questions. But I think you're trying to actually address something that comes prior to these suggestions, and I think that's something that would be very, very powerful.
No, I think that, thank you, because I think... you've pointed out a direction for me to respond to these criticisms. You know, it's kind of hints in the beginning of the paper where I talk about Whitman's turn to the resources of the ordinary, right? To the kind of quote Cavell, the Stanley Cavell's work there, and that is the kind of the prior to something like shared values, right? Prior to something like, you know, because Whitman, like, you know, Thoreau or Emerson, deeply critical of the mere conventionalisms, right, that hold a society together, right? Deeply critical of the habits and the institutions that force us to live lives of what Thoreau called quiet desperation, right? So he clearly doesn't want to look to those conventions, whether those conventions be kind of the institutions around us or the stereotypes we have in our head that we bring to these urban encounters, all of the, you know, it's the relations of hierarchy and status that I think you rightly note in your comments, Will, but to something that is kind of prior to that, right? And I like that. That would be the direction that I would go in trying to respond to that set of criticisms. And with that in mind, then I think the question becomes, and I have received, you know, I gave this paper earlier at Hopkins, and somebody asked me the question, you know, there's a quote in the paper where I talk about Whitman's relationship to the prostitute, right? He has this discussion of the prostitute, and Whitman says, "I'm both in and out of the game," right? He descends to the paves. He's capable of mingling within the crowd and articulating a poetic voice from within the crowd, but there's also always a distance,
It's not the distance of the flaneur I talk about in the paper, right? But it is this game of kind of unsettling. It's something like a pathos of distance, right? It's removed and attached. So the question, and I think this is in part what Will is asking me, is that capacity democratically distributed, right? And I want to say, why can't the prostitute have that relationship of critical unsettlement and attachment? It seems to me that saying that is only something that's available to, and let's say Whitman, you know, white man, you know, the status, his social identity, is to kind of trap people within their subjectivities, but within a kind of standpoint epistemology. And I do think that Whitman is trying to resist that. I think that he sees that as confining and undemocratic. So that would be, I'm kind of taking your good advice as a way of responding I don't know, fully responding, but I think that would be how I would begin to formulate a response to Will's first question. Anyway. Steve, thanks.
I guess I want to try to get to see if I can push you toward an example of this disposition and how it kind of manifests itself, might manifest itself in democratic collective action, and manifest more specific kinds of democratic principles, say. And one thing that I really like about the paper is you do a good job of showing why George Kateb's Whitman doesn't exactly work. That is, you draw out enough quotations to show that Kateb's worry that Whitman's democratic aestheticism becomes too close to virulent nationalism. In other words, that would be an example of this kind of democratic aestheticism going off the rails, and right. It's not what he intends. But then I see that at one end of the spectrum, a kind of virulent nationalism. And then when I try to envision the other end of the spectrum that this democratic aestheticism might give rise to, I'm trying to see what it might mean. I was thinking of something like Band-Aid, and say large crowds in a concert that's aiming toward some sort of legitimate democratic collective action, that is aiding people in another country yeah. who are impoverished. So I see all of this sort of activity in this crowd of people going on that you're talking about, and it being related to a we that has enough political
yeah.
Coherence at a moment to, you know, actually raise a lot of money for very worthy activities. But then it fundamentally dissipates.
Yeah.
And maybe there are some good things to that, but it makes a little more problematic what it would actually mean, or whether there would be any more sustained kind of activity and orientation of citizenship yeah. from that kind of experience.
So because it's necessarily ephemeral? Because
well,
I mean, what's
yeah,
the
that it does seem to be ephemeral in terms of how it can connect up with action.
Yeah.
So the so
I see what you're
if
asking,
that
Stephen.
If that example doesn't work, then you know what kind of example could you draw me toward
okay.
that would let me see how it would
yeah,
work?
I mean, I think that there are a couple of things to say about that. I don't think there's a lot of emphasis in the paper, and there's a lot of emphasis in Whitman's poetry on these furtive, on glances, on indirection, right? So there's a kind of temporality to that which seems fleeting or fugitive, right? In Woolen's sense, Whitman. This is not a theory of fugitive democracy. I think he says at one point that we want to instill these capacities as a possession and enduring habit, right? So it's not just their fleetingness, I think, that or it's not the fleetingness, I guess, that should be emphasized. I think, Stephen, that it's more, you know, that sense of wonder in the face of encountering others, what William James really draws out in Whitman's writing as he attributes significance to alien lives, right? Alien lives, we come to see them as having a significance. And I try to show in the poet, in a reading of some of the poems from Leaves of Grass, how you get this processional encounter with other people in the street, right? And he works up from these kind of perceptions a series of reflections, kind of, I could be you, I could be you, I could be you, I could, you know, so there's this sense of kind of attachment and wonder. But the attachment is something that I think is not fleeting, but you come to have this sense of shared capacity. I mean, this is where I think this paper relates to an earlier essay that I wrote on Whitman on aesthetic democracy, where, you know, the argument of that paper, one central argument is that Whitman tries to present the people to themselves as a sublime formative power, right? To give them some sense of their collective efficacy, right? As people engaged in transformative democratic practice, but that can have an institutional dimension, right? I mean, he celebrates the contests of American party politics. It's not wholly detached from institutions, but he also thinks that too much focus has been placed on institutions and laws and policies. So I don't see it as being ephemeral in that sense, or maybe I want to go through and make sure that that's not what I'm trying. That's, I mean, I realize that in the poetry there's an emphasis on its furtive, you know, and its indirection, its furtiveness, but he's really trying to establish an enduring sensibility that I think is compatible with, you know, participation in formal channels of political participation like elections.
So we have in the back, and then George.
Excuse me, I didn't read the whole paper, so I'm just responding to your comments, so there's a lot left out. But I don't know if there is a sort of a step you're taking here, which is a recommendation, as it were, if this is an academic discussion. But if it's verging toward a direction, i.e. Obama will call upon us to sacrifice the nation in order to move forward. And how can he bind us together to move forward? And so if it's going toward a recommendation, then I just wanted to point out an academic named Ashtoy Varshney. Maybe you've read his work. He's an Indian, but he works here at University of Michigan, I think. I'm not sure.
Ashtoy Varshney?
Ashtoy Varshney, Varshney. And he studies crowds in India. And he says, you know, the Hindus and the Muslims they seem to get along in the streets during the day. And, of course, it's a very crowded place there. You know, there are lots of promiscuous
mixings,
affective moments, you know, between people. Anyway, but when there's a sort of a trigger point, when push comes to shove at certain moments, then he studies why there are conflagrations between ethnic groups in some cities and under the same stresses in other cities or other communities, there are not these conflagrations.
Yeah.
And he determined, basically, that if people, it's a very plebeian, it doesn't have to do with aesthetics, particularly, you know, or that sort of thing. But if people actually work together, like Hindu and Muslim women work on a PTA project, and they have that level of involvement where they've struggled, they've had conflicts, and they've resolved things, that those communities do not, under stresses, go into a kind of violent circumstance. But where it's just been street kind of promiscuous interchange, they will. They'll adhere to their own identities. So, anyway.
No, that's helpful and interesting. Whether this is moving to prescription or, you know, where my voice is situated in relationship to Whitman's, I mean, I'm trying here to give him as full and generous a reading as I can with this theory of promiscuous citizenship, and to try to see how it might connect up with some much more forthrightly normative debates in contemporary democratic theory. So, in my concluding comments where I said, I'm interested in how he wrestles with this, but in thinking about it more fully, like enable, for example, to more fully respond, I think, to Will's good concerns and questions, I think you'd have to drop Whitman as an anchor, maybe, and begin to tease out what some of the limitations are. So I'm trying to do kind of both here, but really just to give him a hearing, you know, to try to piece together what I take to be a kind of provocative and persuasive theory of citizenship as affective relating. So that's the first question. The second question about crowds and the example of kind of Hindu and Muslim crowds. You know, I see Whitman as confronted, and I bring this up briefly in the paper. I mean, he's working against a very long tradition of thinking about the passions of crowds as deeply dangerous politically. They close down spaces of critical reflection. They make deliberation impossible. I mean, you know, I kind of focus on the American political tradition here, but of course it's a much longer tradition than that. It goes back to the ancients. But I think he's trying to kind of, you know, when I say he's trying to refigure how people perceive, like a kind of mode of perception, what it is we get from a crowd mixing with the crowd, he wants to see crowds as also productive or provocative of thinking, of reflection, of critical distance. That's why he talks about the curious, abrupt questionings that continually come to him when he's mixing with the crowds on Broadway. Now, that might not come naturally. That requires a kind of the cultivation of a certain sensibility, right? And it's in part through his poetry that he's trying to cultivate that sensibility, to enliven his readers to that capacity. Typical pictures of crowds, you know, the passionate, contagious crowd, the violent crowd, the draft crowd. There are a lot of historical examples that would bear, you know, that give us evidence of that. But he wants to suggest that that is not the only way that human beings relate to one another as crowds. And he's trying to pick up this other dimension, articulate it, poetically translate it, and kind of vivify that understanding of what it is to be in a crowd among his public. I mean, the concluding couple of pages, which I guess you didn't get to, but I talk about the frontispiece from the first edition, and remind me of your name again. Chris brought it up in his question. I mean, one of the things that I want to claim is that, yeah, here's a picture of it. In the first edition of Leaves of Grass, Whitman replaces his name with this engraving that's based on a daguerreotype of him kind of dressed up as a rough and kind of staring somewhat insolently out at in a kind of challenging way, out at the viewer. And one of the things that I want to argue, he later refers to this image as the street figure, which is really convenient for the argument that I want to make, because I want to suggest that in replacing his name with that image, Whitman is kind of trying, is declaring how he wants the poetry of Leaves. He's kind of he's working up against the limits of textual mediation, right? He wants the poetry itself to be disseminated in a public and to kind of disseminate something like these encounters on the urban street and the democratically productive aspects of those encounters that he kind of poetically translates in Leaves of Grass. So, I'll stop there. Thanks.
We have George and then Sid. Anybody else want to get in the list?
Yeah, my reaction's like Will's, and I'm interested in how well you think this thing actually works. And I think you do a great job of showing how Whitman is actually an interesting democratic theorist, in that we have this idea of the sentimental side of connections between citizens, and he goes beyond other theorists and actually trying to write a work that's going to generate these connections. And there's a kind of grandiosity here,
yeah. In
that your last sentence, Whitman hoped that his work would help to reinvigorate democratic life in the United States and provide a new aesthetic basis for the weakened bonds of the Union. You know, it's very high aspiration. There's a long tradition of theorists having great faith in their own work. In the laws, Plato wants to kick all other poetry out of Magnesia and have them only read the laws.
Right.
And then Hobbes wanted us all to meet every Saturday and read with Hyatt then.
The whole thing at each Saturday?
Well, you know, like
only the first two books.
on a cycle. You know, so there's a question here about the kinds of media that actually are capable of generating these connections between people. And if you think about that question, it's a sociological question. But I like Renan's remark, what is a nation?
Absolutely.
A nation is a group of people bound together by mistaken views of its history and hatred of its neighbors.
That's exactly what he's right.
Well,
it's also a daily plebiscite for Renan.
Well, but I like the more colorful remark. You know, so the question here is that I've never found Whitman very accessible. And, you know, I just don't know how popular he was, how well received. I know that literate people liked him a great deal, but did the masses actually respond to this sort of poetry as opposed to, say, the poetry of Longfellow? And even Book Two, Chapter 7 of Rousseau, Rousseau's Lawgiver does not appeal to the crowd on an intellectual level.
Absolutely.
You know, he generates a popular religion. And if you think about what really creates these sentimental bonds among Americans, you get something like Irving Berlin, you know, God Bless America, or these MGM movies, you know, they're popular media.
Right.
And I just don't know how popular Whitman was, but I wonder if, you know, this sort of poetry is capable of having the kind of effects he wants.
No, that's a good question. I mean, I think, so there's the kind of political theory question, and then there's the historical question. And Whitman surely had a very overblown and grandiose idea of what of the political efficacy of poetry, right? I don't think, and that's a romantic, you know, he's not alone in this. I mean, he's deeply influenced by Emerson's essay, The Poet, which makes similarly kind of grand claims. But I do think, so this is a romantic trope. I mean, you can think of Byron, the poet is the legislator of the world, right? This like connects it to Book 2, Chapter 7 of Rousseau's Social Contract. Whitman works in that tradition and resists it. And what he resists in it is his non-democratic character, right? So he has a very interesting exchange, well, not really an exchange. Democratic Vistas, the essay that he wrote in 1871, is largely a response to Carlyle, to the work of Carlyle, who had this, the people must be drilled, you know, the people must be disciplined, and in part that drilling is kind of literal drilling, must be kind of martially, you know, disciplined. But there's also the sense that the great literatus, you know, has this formative power, can shape a democratic people, make them beautiful, right? The great lawgiver. So Whitman is attracted by that and wants to resist it, which is in part why I think he places so much emphasis on, you know, he's neither simply representing the people, describing them to themselves, right? There's some kind of translation going on, just like Rousseau's lawgiver is no mere copyist, Rousseau says. But he's trying to render aesthetically aspects that are already there in their democratic life, right? So their embodiment, their vulgarity, things that have not been given aesthetic significance are rendered aesthetically significant by his work. So they don't feel gaggery and guilt, he says. We should stop feeling gaggery and guilt at our democratic selves, right? So that's large pretensions, George, you're right. I mean, did he think really that leaves of grass, you know, disseminated throughout the states and kind of stitch the weakened bonds of union and do so in this robustly democratic way? He had very high aspirations, and he was gravely disappointed by the weak sales of Leaves of Grass after its initial publication. And it was really only late, you know, he begins to acquire a very international reputation very late in his life, especially among literary folks. But of course, it's really, you know, Whitman is canonized. the canonization has only grown. Right? The poet, the prophet of American democracy, this kind of idea, the seer, right? So I think that he did
have those aspirations. He was disappointed in them. But he has, I mean, reading the essay Democratic Vistas from 1871, which is pretty late, like that's where you really get an argument about how, I mean, it's all about literature for him. So you think about the different media, right, through which these kinds of set aesthetic sensibilities might be distributed. He mentions different media. He mentions the daguerreotype. You know, he was closely engaged in kind of debates around the arts and aesthetics in his time, but he really had thought that poetry, there was a special place for poetry, even while he resisted the mediation of poetry, the fact that poetry, you know, I have this quote at the very end, I think I'll quote this every time I write about Whitman, but come closer to me, I was chilled with the cold types and cylinder and the wet paper between us. I pass so poorly with paper and types, I must pass with the contact of bodies and souls, and this said via paper and types, right? So there's that acknowledgement of the limits of the media through which this presence is going to be distributed, and an acknowledgement and a resistance to it. I guess that's how I'd respond.
Sid?
I want to thank you and Will. It's just really interesting. And I'm not a political theorist, so Chris is right. This does draw in non-political theorists. I just had two quick comments. First, has to do with you mentioned people like Jefferson and Thoreau and Tocqueville who had great concerns about the city and felt that this urbanization would destroy the American Republic. But particularly since you're working on them, as I understand. You ought to go back to Publius and the Federalist Papers, people like Madison and Hamilton, or
especially
James
Hamilton,
Wilson, because what's really radical and interesting about the Federalist Papers is that they have an idea of a cosmopolitan citizenry, and that's
in opposition to the anti-federalists.
My students think this is conservative, but this is really a radical notion in 1787. Now, of course, they believe that to make that work, to make the cosmopolitan citizenry work, you have to have the people believe in the Constitution. So Madison says that the Constitution, he doesn't want the Constitution to change a lot because it must become the religion of the people. And then Lincoln, as Will pointed out, believes that the Declaration has to become the civic religion of the people. The Constitution is just a path to the fulfillment of the Declaration. Now, what I'm curious about is what's the difference between a cosmopolitan citizenry as described by Publius, his ambition, versus a promiscuous citizenship, the poet's sense of citizenship. And this is, you say that Will said, I don't know if Will's accurately invoking you, but Will said this replaces the law. The Constitution and the Declaration at least are de-emphasized. They become less important in the face of this imagined democracy. And I wonder whether it's supposed to replace that or supplement. Like Tocqueville says, you have to have mores in addition to the law because the law in and of itself doesn't do it.
I think it's much closer to that. It's not about replacement.
Yeah.
I mean, the question about Publius is interesting. You don't get a celebration of the city in the Federalist Papers. You get a celebration or the vision of the American Republic is a commercial republic.
Yeah.
It's a commercial republic.
Yeah.
So you get, there's some kind of cosmopolitanism there. It's a cosmopolitanism, I would argue, that's closely bound up with commercialism. So the idea is, you know, when Publius looks out to the West is the kind of endless productive resources of the West, right? So you move West and this nature's bounty that is given to America, which has been obstructed, kind of artificially obstructed by the weak federal government under the Articles of Confederation, will be allowed to realize its natural, kind of providential, even, future possibilities. So it's not about cities so much. I think it's about commercialism. I think it's about a commercial republic. Now, the Jefferson-Thoreau bit in the paper and what and Tocqueville too. Tocqueville as a way of kind of just generally setting it up. And one of the things that I think is interesting, and as I was writing this paper and kind of really going back with an eye to look at how the city is invoked or mentioned in some of the more canonical works of American political thought. Krevker's Letters from an American Farmer is really fascinating on the city. But a sub theme, I guess, that developed as I was writing this is you see a real shift from the Jeffersonian agrarian republicanism, where the language is primarily a language of corruption, right? So you get this emphasis on how cities corrupt. Cities corrupt by making people economically dependent upon one another, rather than kind of independent landowning out on the yeoman farmer, which provides the material basis for intellectual and political independence. But they also corrupt morally, right? There's a kind of abnormal libidinousness in the city, and this is where the Jeffersonian kind of Republican critique overlaps with the more Christian moralist critique of the city. I talk about this in the paper. But there's a real shift in Emerson and Thoreau, in the transcendentalists. It's no longer the language of corruption. It's the much more modern Rousseau, I think, a much more modern language of alienation. That urban spaces and relationships between individuals in urban spaces are alienated relationships, right? They're mediated by false conventions and false determinations. We're other directed, right? We act for others. We see ourselves through the eyes of others. That's a very Rousseauian, that's Rousseauian alienation, right? Thoreau and Emerson very much picked that up. And in Emerson's journals, I mean, that's where the most profound articulations of this kind of urban theories of alienation, I think, comes out. And Whitman, I think, is critically responding to both of those. I think that he wants to say that cities are not corrupting, and that they're far from being alienating. They are enlivening. They are what produces a kind of democratic form of citizenship. And the intersubjectivity between people in these urban spaces, which Thoreau in the Village chapter of Walden sees as deadening, and it's a mere mechanical contact, et cetera, et cetera. I think Whitman's kind of groping for a theory of something like intersubjectivity. It's not a full-blown theory. This is where I would really differ from K-Teb's reading of Whitman. But, you know, Whitman didn't only read Kant, he also read Hegel. And for little bits of Hegel, he read little bits translated of Hegel.
I'm trying to hear that.
Yeah. He's not a Hegelian. That's not what I'm saying. But I think there is a kind of groping with something like what will become a more full-blown theory of intersubjectivity.
Yeah. It's not surprising that progressives like him a lot.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Crowley, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Partially answered my question when you were speaking to the issue of the poet as making an impact as a social critic.
Yeah.
You know, what has really come of Leaves of Grass, but also going back to the comment that the woman made there about India and our present day.
Yeah.
You know, what is possible for the poet to make an impact? Here at the Miller Center, those of us who have been coming here for years and years, we're really concerned about, you know, the state of our nation and the world now.
Yeah.
And being an old English major myself and now I'm a psychologist, because I gave it up because I couldn't see how I was going to make a difference.
Yeah.
Doing that. And I still write poetry. But I'm curious if you could bring what you've gotten from studying Whitman and what happened with him and what we can see as possible now in the media age that we're in now that could be useful.
Yeah. I don't have a very optimistic response to that question. Certainly not where poetry comes into consideration. But
it's a pretty good turnout here today.
Well, that's true. Did everybody know that this was about Walt Whitman?
They might come into the wrong room.
Yeah, exactly. But they stay. The question of media. I mean, I think that Whitman's, perhaps even in the middle of the 19th century, overblown hope for the capacities of poetry disseminated among a citizenry to have these formative influences is maybe even overblown in the time of his writing. Certainly poetry now would not be the first media that I would think of to think of in terms of these kind of effects. In this ball, so I'm I'm not going to hypothesize. You know, I think you're right that images, digital media. I mean, all kinds of media that have much more efficacy and involve very different questions. Really, I mean, Whitman reflects profoundly, I think, on the media of poetry. I think he has a very he kind of theorizes the media of the book, right? This object, the book that circulates. He was very involved in layout and design of the books, right? So he took them seriously as kind of material things, right, that were to circulate. So that kind of reflectivity about different media and what certain kinds of media enable and what they preclude, that line of consideration seems to me working very much in a Whitmanian vein of reflection, even if he doesn't have the substantive answers for us here and now. But that as an important question, that seems to me like he asks those questions. So I'll end the answer to your question by saying in this volume that this piece will ultimately be in, I know there's another essay called The Whitman Effect by Michael Shapiro that really takes Whitman into more contemporary context and thinks about how some of the similar, you know, we have a similar kind of interest in the way that Whitman is attentive to poetic enactment, like what it elicits among its readers and its audiences. But Michael's piece looks at many more kind of contemporary media that work, in his argument, in a Whitmanian vein. Right? They're examples of a contemporary Whitman effect. So
we have an abat.
Yeah. Terrific paper, Jason. I really enjoyed it. Actually, my question does build off of some of your comments on media and layout. I guess it just asks a kind of follow-up on that. About the image and the fact that it comes first in his volume, and your discussion of that is very interesting. And of course, it is partly because it presents an unmediated contact with Whitman, not unlike what he's
right.
talking about in Leaves of Grass.
Right.
And even more interesting, I think, is the way that the reader, well, you make the point that it's approached as a viewer before as a reader.
Right.
And so I want to ask about your decision as an author to put Whitman's image at the end of the piece. and so that we approach it in a highly mediated fashion.
Yeah.
As a reader, not as a viewer. And as a reader, not of Whitman, but of Jason Frank.
Yeah.
So I want to ask about your...
So I've done the precise work of containment that I celebrate Whitman for eschewing. Right? Yeah.
Well, I guess one way you could respond is by putting a picture of yourself at the
Well, here I am. Not just textual mediation. I don't know how to. I mean, I think you're right. Right. So I've prefigured our encounter with that image by all of the argument that comes before it. I mean, I'm very interested in that image, the proper name, how the proper name, Foucault's kind of the author effect, right? How that confines a reading, like all of a sudden certain associations. You know, in Whitman's case, probably not too much because he wasn't exactly a known author or a known entity in 1855 when he published that first edition. But, you know, I guess I'll say in response to that guy that in a longer version, what might be a longer version of this paper, one of the things that interests me are the different kind of modalities of self-representation in Whitman's work, the different pictures that he has, like Lincoln. Lincoln was very much like this too, right? We know that Lincoln was deeply attentive to the daguerreotypes that were taken of him. I mean, the famous one that he used in one of the presidential campaigns that he, in one of his letters, basically accredited with winning him the election. It's this very composed. I mean, you've all seen it, but I can't. I don't have the image right in front of me, so I can't describe it well. But Whitman was also very attuned to these questions. So, in a longer version of this paper, I contrast this image, the image of the rough, the street figure, from 18. The daguerreotype itself was taken, I think, in 1854, and it's used as an engraving in 1855. With an earlier photograph of Whitman from the time that he spent writing and editing New York City newspapers, the Aurora, right? And there he is a dandy, He is absolutely. He has a cane. He has a tie. He's bound. You know, he's dressed up. He's a man on the town. He's a flaneur. He's very much like this kind of image of the flaneur. Precisely what I argue Whitman is not in Leaves of Grass. So that's not exactly an answer to your question. It's a way of getting. But I do take very seriously. You know, it's not the poetry itself is not just a mode of representation, but he in reflecting very critically on the capacities and the limits of the book as a medium, he's also very attentive to the new technologies and what they make available, like in the dissemination of these images.
We have Shushan. I have a question, and I think that might be our time. So let's do Shushan, and then let's see if we can make Carmen.
I like this romantic thinking, at least it's met my brain very satisfied. But after the brain satisfaction, the question is still, how can we cultivate this kind of love among citizens who are not a political, a historical, but living together with mutual misunderstood, mutual hatred, not mention about the hierarchy, social hierarchy. So my two questions. First is, how to apply the theory into the world? Second is, if we consider about the reality, is it possible to apply the romantic thinking into the social reality?
Wait, ask the second, I didn't get the second one as a question.
Is that possible to cultivate
The
romantic thinking.
I see what you're saying. Well, this kind of gets back to George's question. Whitman is a poet, right? So this is one mode of achieving something like, you know, the dissemination of a set of aesthetic sensibilities that might vitalize democratic citizenship and the way that we understand and perceive our relationship to others. There are the limits with poetry as being, right? But I think that, you know, what's interesting to me, so the how can we, the question like how to apply it, I mean, you know, may a thousand flowers bloom. I mean, I don't think you're limited to one or another media. I think what's interesting about Whitman, I mean, one is what we've been talking about in the last few minutes, is the really, you know, quite sophisticated theoretical reflection on the capacities and limitations of certain media. That translates to our time. I think that broad concern translates to our time. But there's a limit to writing, right? There's a limit to poetry. The romantic imagination, the overblown understanding of the efficacy of poetry. I mean, I almost want to say that Whitman himself was aware of that, in that he constantly talks about, you know, he talks about, and I quote these passages in the paper, about wanting to convince by his presence, right? So a great critic, one of the best essays on Whitman that I know is by a poet and critic, Alan Grossman, where he talks about Whitman aiming in his poetry for an infinite distributability of affectionate presence, right? So the poetry aims for a kind of affectionate presence. Now, there are other ways in which you can think, just working simply within, right, of trying to disseminate something like, I mean, in fact, poetry would probably not be the first media that we would think of as having that kind of capacity. But nonetheless, it is Whitman's, and that's one of the reasons why I think he wrestles with the very media of his poetic presentation. I don't know the answer to the how to, but I don't think that Whitman himself is aware of the limitations of not just poetry but of writing.
So I have a question for you. I really enjoyed the paper, and I am sort of attracted to this sort of mode of thinking about how to affectively bind the community, and I am attracted to this idea through two examples. The one is in W.E. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, where he is talking about the Freedmen's Bureau. And he's talking about the failure of the Freedmen's Bureau. Mm-hmm. And he says that the Freedmen's Bureau presupposed the thing it had to create.
Mm-hmm.
Goodwill, right? Now, goodwill for Du Bois is really sort of suffused with an affirmation of our common humanity that is partly distilled from common principles that we share. The other example that I'm thinking of is an example, a famous example, Little Rock, Arkansas High, desegregation, Arkansas, right, nine, and Elizabeth Eckford, one of the students, going off to school, trying to get into the school. And Danielle Allen describes her leaving her home, going to this school, knowing that she's going to face humiliation and potentially violence. That Elizabeth walked in the world to see if there was enough political friendship that would sustain the democratic institutions and would build trust out of distrust. Right.
Right?
But the vision of political friendship that Allen is working with is also a vision of common humanity grounded in shared principles that have developed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question for Du Bois and the question for Allen is not whether we can get behind our conventions, since conventions are the only things that allow us to see each other, to appropriately regard each other. The question is good or bad conventions, right? And so I'm not your description of Whitman presents, I think, a fundamental problem, that somehow there's a kind of immediacy to our experience that comes prior to our convention, could ever come prior to our conventions, right? That they're not already filtered.
Yeah.
And if they're already filtered, right, isn't it the case that there are conventions that distort our way of seeing each other, and then there are conventions that can expand our conceptions. So the strangers on the street, blacks and whites, 19th century New York, right?
Yeah,
there's exchange of glances,
absolutely,
but it's an exchange of acquiescence on one side and domination on the other.
No, I think, I mean, Mel, it's a very good question. I think that there is a difference here. We talked about, we did our last night, we talked a little, and I've thought about these things a bit more, and I think that I would want to make, I do want to make a distinction, and I think Whitman's work allows us to make a distinction, not just between mediated relations and therefore conventions on the one hand and pure immediacy on the other. So presence, right? Some kind of pure experience, unmediated experience. I do think that there is maybe an option left out in that opposition. And I think you could begin to kind of think about it theoretically in terms of the relationship between conventions, the stereotypes, the habits of interacting with one another, not just like the stereotype, the representations, the politics of the different representations we might have of others, but also as they're, you know, these things settle into our physical reactions with others, right? But between those kind of conventions, which Whitman was also deeply critical of, this is where he's with Emerson and with Thoreau. He thinks the conventions lead us to live lives of this kind of dull repetition, right? That Walden is, you know, Thoreau goes to Walden Pond to kind of free himself from these false determinations. Those false determinations are largely conventional determinations, right? Get back to life. What are the determinations of life itself? The determinations of life is something like the ordinary, right? And the everyday. That I don't think is reducible to conventions. So I think that might come between mere conventionalism on the one hand and pure immediacy of experience and the metaphysics of presence that is bound up with that. So that would be my that's how I would respond to that concern.
Okay. So I think that's our time. Unfortunately, we have to give up the room at 2 o'clock from my understanding. So
thank you very much.
So I want to thank Jason.
Very helpful.
And we'll be back here in the spring with Sarah Song once again on citizenship, democratic theory, and immigration.
Thanks.
Yeah.